Okay, should remember that this week is Parsha Zohar, and that's a mitzvah of itself, which maybe we'll talk about afterwards, but to start with the Haftorah is a very intense experience. The Haftorah is from Sefer Shmuel Aleph, and essentially it is the downfall of Shaul, not the actual downfall yet, but what is the cause of his eventually losing the Melucha. And it is connected to the theme of our Kriya, the Shabbos, not because of Parshas Vayikra, although maybe we'll have the opportunity to make reference to that, but it's the connection to Parshas Zohar, to the theme of Amalek, that is the theme of this Haftorah. And essentially, the Parsha describes how Shmuel is told that Shaul has done something wrong, that Shaul is not going to continue to be the king. And what emerges is that what he did, or what he didn't do, is that he didn't fully carry out his chiyuv of Mechiyas Amalek in the context of the war with Agag. And he spared not only the king, but he also spared some of the animals. He spared the better animals. And there is a whole dialogue back and forth where ultimately Shaul has to acknowledge that what he did was wrong, but it's a back and forth, and there is an effort to defend it and to rationalize and to take different approaches as to what exactly was the story here. And it's not 100% clear from the Psukim. We get some conflicting perspectives whether this was really the nation's initiative and Shaul was listening to them, or whether this was Shaul's decision. And as is often the case, I point you to the Mitoch Ohel volume. So this week is certainly no exception. There is a fascinating article by our dear friend Dr. David Schatz, who talks about a number of possibilities in terms of what's going on here. Is there self-deception going on? Does Shaul really think that he was right? Does he realize that he was wrong, and it's more of a subconscious realization, while on the surface he feels that he needs to argue? And among the points that Shaul makes is that he spared the animals in order to bring them as korbanos. And that's clearly an inadequate defense. Did he think it was an adequate defense? Is that something that could have made sense? So all of this is discussed in great detail in Dr. Schatz's article, very highly recommended, as all of his writings. And there's a lot to consider. There is a Gemara particularly, and a few Midrashim as well. The Gemara Maseches Yuma and Daf Chav Beis talks about the dialogue here. The Gemara picks up on the phrase that we have here in the Haftorah. It is second, which is pasuk. Vayarav Banachal. Yeah, here it is, pasuk hey. V'yavu Shaul adi Amalek, Vayarav Banachal. So the Gemara has a drasha on this pasuk, that Vayarav, that he argued regarding the Nachal. And the Gemara suggests that Shaul was protesting the whole idea of killing Amalek, whether it's because
the Gemara there says that he was arguing the Indian of killing.
Yeah, and again, whether his motive here was Rachmanis or was it something else is also not clear. We find the language of a Yachmol, as if he had Chemla, as if he had mercy on them. So the Gemara relates a dialogue that this Vayarav Banachal, that he was arguing about an Indian related to Nachal, is Egla Rufa. And so what comes to Egla Rufa, so here you have one person die, and we get so concerned about it, we make such efforts to explain and to account how could that happen, even if it wasn't a direct killing. And yet here you're telling us to kill the entire nation, even if people are guilty. So the women guilty? Are the children guilty? Are the animals guilty? So it seems like he was arguing it on a Rachmanis basis, a moral basis, although it's also hard to square with what actually happens here, because if that's really what's bothering him, so then why spare the animals at the end and not the children? So he argues about the children and the animals, but in the end it's the animals that he spares. And it's the idea of the better animals as opposed to the less good animals. So what exactly is going on there? How does that reflect what he's arguing? It's itself a problem. And who's up first? Is Maury up first?
Maury first.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Once we're like playing around with the psychological analysis of his plea over here, mm-hmm. it's so far-fetched to say that if Shaul is coming from a place of this seems to be an uncomfortable thing, especially laid next to a tzivoy of or an Indian, I guess a parsha really of Agla Rufa, where that displays a sensitivity towards a loss of life. Maybe after like he's so, I feel like it's not so hard to imagine him so distraught at the entire thing that he's grasping at one last thing to spare and then spares the animals as like a. That might be a stretch.
Yeah, it might be a little bit of a stretch, but it's interesting to have Rachmanis and Shaul. Hi.
So if it says, like, I'm pretty sure Hashem says in Zohar, right, that his throne will be complete until all the Malik
is wiped out.
Demolished, why doesn't he just mean drop in? I never really understood that.
Right, so that's itself. So there, interesting things to explore about the mitzvah of Melchamas Amalek in general, and how much of it is HaKadosh Baruch Hu's war against the Amalek, and how much of it is our war against the Amalek. We can get into that a little bit more. It seems that why he'd have to make him drop dead, you know, that we can certainly understand, that it's not that God can't deal with the Amalek as if they're challenging him in a real way. It's that his message is contradicted by Amalek's presence. And it's upon us to understand how that's contradicted and how that has to be addressed. If Amalek was just never here in the first place, then that wouldn't necessarily accomplish that. So that, I think, we get, even though it's true that the Psukim give us somewhat conflicting impressions about whether it's God's war or our war, and how exactly to relate to that. But in any event, if Shaul is making this argument that it's not fair, so then it's not clear how that actually plays out in what he actually did. The Gemara there in Yuma tells us that when he made this point, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to him, he quotes the Pasuk, "Al ti tzadik harbe," that don't think that you can be firmer than God. And we have the notion there that whoever is merachim al ha'achzar, sofar al achzer al rachman, that whoever is soft on the cruel, ultimately, he ends up being cruel on the soft. He ends up being cruel to the people who deserve mercy. And both from the Gemara and just in terms of its literal interpretation, there are at least two levels to that. That one is that if you allow the immediate Rachmanis to get in the way of what needs to be done, and you have Rachmanis in the sense that you let the violent go unpunished, so that's going to end up allowing those violent people to continue in their violent action, and they're going to go after innocent people. So you're going to end up, the Maisa, expressing cruelty to those who deserve Rahmanas. And that's clearly a theme here, because that's why we're reading Zohar now. Right? We're reading Zohar attached to Purim, because our tradition is that Haman is a descendant of who he spares, of Agag. So from that perspective, the message is clear, that had you gotten rid of Agag then, so you wouldn't have to deal with Haman later on. You know, it's a famous philosophical question: if you could go back in time and kill Hitler, would you? And that has a lot of levels to it, that question. But on some level, you're seeing that playing out here, that we're reading Purim time as we talk about Haman. So we're reading, on the one hand, in the Torah, we're reading the Kriya of Amalek. But even more targeted, in a sense, is the Haftorah, which tells us that the situation of Haman is allowed to happen because Agag is left. So, not exactly, but symbolically, the Maisa doesn't work out that way, but the message seems to be that evil persists because it wasn't fully addressed. So that's one perspective. But the way the Gemara continues the point is also another aspect to it, that the Gemara says that Shaul was equally guilty for having the Kohanim of Nov killed. And to that, you have the other part of the Pasuk, Al Tirsha Harbe, you should not be too evil. So, in that level, the implication is that when a person has a misplaced sense of Rachmanis, so then all kinds of kilkulim arise in his personality, all kinds of deviations can come from that. So, it can manifest itself today as excessive compassion, and tomorrow as excessive harshness, as excessive violence. So once you're out of balance, and once you're allowing the more emotional component to govern the situation against what is supposed to happen, al pi din, so then there could be problems in the other direction as well. So it emerges that this idea of Rachmanis on the Achzar leading to cruelty on the Rachaman is on two levels. That you're simply allowing the Rachman to be vulnerable to the Achzar, but also within oneself, that once that's out of balance, it doesn't just go in that direction. It creates all kinds of imbalances that go in the opposite direction as well. And Chafetz Chaim, his commentary on the Chumash, I believe, has commented that you have the inverse effect, that because he didn't fully wipe them all out, so then why is he guilty? What is his real source of punishment? Because now all the killing that he did do was illegitimate. That had he done it kedasu kedin, so okay, so then that's a mitzvah mechias amalek. But since he did it selectively, so it's not the Rachmanis that gets him in trouble, as much as the fact that the Rachmanis is megala, that what justified the killing that he did do. If it wasn't from a kiyum of the mitzvah of amalek, because he's not following those rules, so then he's in trouble for that. And that's also a very powerful point, that especially in mitzvahs like this, it's crucial to stick exactly to the din and no further. This is clearly not an area where there's any concept of lifnim meshuras hadin that we can add on. And that's a great danger we spoke about a few weeks ago that we find today also, that especially a mitzvah like this, the potential for taking your own interpretation and running with it and allowing it to define your attitudes is particularly dangerous. Hi.
Oh, we spoke to him before about the partial tshuva.
Yeah.
I don't know if it applies in other mitzvahs also, but like, why wouldn't you have a concept of partially fulfilling a mitzvah?
You could. You certainly. I mean, it's an interesting discussion. We spoke this week also about the Chatzi Shir by Averos, and there's an interesting discussion in Achronim about Chatzi Shir by mitzvos. But Chatzi Shir by mitzvos can mean a lot of different things. You know, so it could mean, for example, if you have only half a kazayis of matzah, is it worth eating on Pesach night? If you only have the ability to do a little bit. So that's one question. But when a person chooses bedavka not to fulfill a mitzvah v'shlimusa, so that might be baltigra. That's how some understand the prohibition of baltigra. And here, again, the point is not that he did as much as he could, is that he chose to do it selectively. So, particularly here, because of the nature of what this involves an act of violence against people. So that violence is only justified because it's coming from the mitzvah, so the Chafetz Chaim's point. So if you're not following the rules of the mitzvah, and you could, you're choosing to make your own decisions, so then what justified that action in the first place? So there are many concerns here. Rav Rivlin, in one of his essays, has a couple of different points, but he focuses on the theme of gaiva, which he perceives within Shaul, and he brings a couple of proofs to that, which is a little bit ironic because we find that Shmuel says to says to Shaul a statement that implies that he's too modest. Says, "Hello, I'm Katna Tabeinach, Haroshiv Te Yisrael Ata," that you may think you're small, but you're the head of the tribes of Bnei Yisrael. But nonetheless, there are indications that he had a certain sense of haughtiness. And that becomes very, very significant, because not only is gaiva a dangerous trait in general, but especially the kind of gaiva, which I think we spoke about this in the past, I think it came up this year in another context, that allows you to think that the rules don't apply to you. So that also becomes a very dangerous trend. And people who have gone on to do very harmful things, particularly from leadership positions, are often those who we find this trait of gaiva as being a driving force within them, and the feeling that, okay, the rules are for everyone else, but I know better than the rules. And that's particularly a harmful instinct as well.
But to an extent, the rules don't apply to them also. Certain rules
sometimes
do not apply to them.
Right, sometimes. But some, it depends what you're talking about. But for the most part, that's not true. So when that's true, menachanami. But that's also a part of what you have to know. So these are among some of the themes that you find in what exactly is going on in this conversation. In terms of the gaiva, it's also noteworthy that the Gemara contrasts with a number of explanations David and Shaul, that David made more mistakes than Shaul and yet was able to continue in his melucha, and Shaul lost his melucha. And the explanation is often given that David was able to acknowledge his mistakes and to learn from them and move on, while Shaul here resists and rationalizes, even though ultimately he does acknowledge it. But that whole instinct to fight it and to not recognize where you've gone wrong, so that's also a major stumbling block as far as being able to continue in a leadership position. So Rabbi Dr. Schatz, in his article, he goes through many different interpretations of what exactly is the truth, isn't the truth, how exactly can you understand what the whole conversation is here. But he also emphasizes the first pasuk of the parak. And it's interesting, this first pasuk of the parak is not read by Ashkenazim. But the Sephardim have this as part of the Haftarah. It's really an unusual issue to just have this one pasuk difference at the beginning. But the first pasuk that the Ashkenazim don't read says, "Vayomer Shmuel al Shaul, Osi Shalach Hashem, L'mshach Chalamelech, Al Amo Al Yisrael, V'yatah Shema L'kol Divrei Hashem." So Shmuel starts off, he says, "I'm the one who was sent to anoint you in the first place. Now, listen to what God has to say." So why does he have to mention that? Why is that a part of the story? And maybe that's why we leave it out of the Haftarah. You know, why is that something that's relevant? That I'm the one who anointed you in the first place. Now listen to God's word. And there are different interpretations. Some suggest that the Malbim writes that this is because he's emphasizing his role as Melech here, and that the war against Amalek is specifically a sivui to the Melech. Maybe that's the reason for bringing it up. Rav Rivlin has a more machshava-oriented essay where he explains why the fight against the Amalek had to be a shutfus from Shaul and Shmuel. So Shaul essentially is being told of Shmuel's role, that Shmuel has to explain how he's connected to the story. But Dr. Schatz discusses this in a different way, in an interesting way. And part of the theme that he develops, one of the many possibilities in terms of what went wrong here, is that Shmuel is criticizing Shaul because Shaul allowed himself to be controlled by the people, which is also what we find indicated in some of the psukim, that it was the people who had this desire and that Shaul shouldn't have listened to them. So Dr. Schatz suggests that here there's a reference to the initial anointing of Shaul as king, because if you recall, so that itself was somewhat of a tricky parsha, that the people demanded a king, And it seems like that wasn't necessarily the perfect idea. And the whole nature of Shaul becoming king was giving in to what the people were demanding, whether it was right or wrong. And therefore, perhaps there is some kind of appropriateness here that his downfall happens the same way, that the same kind of king, okay, you wanted a king who was going to be the subject of your demands, so too, that's how he ends up ruling, and there are other instances of this in the history also, and that's ultimately his downfall. The same kind of attitude that brought him in the first place is what leads to his downfall. So it suggests maybe that's what's going on here with Shaul being told at the very beginning about this history, being reminded of this history. It's in order to draw a connection between that and this. Hi.
I'm just curious as to how we would understand that in light of what Rivlin was saying before, and focusing on the idea of Gaiva. Is Shaul's allowing of himself to be controlled by the people, is that, like you pointed out, Shmuel is coming from a place of, like, in tune with Shmuel's chastising him, that he was making himself too small and he wasn't asserting himself, or is it more that it was like within Gaiva that he wanted to be accepted as king, and therefore he was just giving him?
So that's not necessarily a stira. You know, but I should first acknowledge that stiras are possible here. That's part of what's one of the major themes that Dr. Schatz emphasizes in an essay, that there's a lot of different interpretations that he's bouncing back and forth, and that perhaps the Nach is particularly meant, at least here, to be open to some conflicting interpretations. So I wouldn't worry necessarily if it's a stira, but that doesn't necessarily have to be. That it could be that itself is the guy with the decision to worry more about having the esteem of the people and doing what they wanted to do may itself be connected to a Gaivadic approach.
I didn't think it was a steer.
Yeah, so right. So it could be. I mean, I think this is open, as Dr. Schatz really is emphasizing as kind of the theme of his article, all the different interpretations that it's open to. But certainly it can be. Hi.
I don't know how much it matters to, like, think like this, but do we view Shaul as someone who is like a good guy, a bad guy? Is he someone who like, he's considered like one of the avos, like that we look up to and we emulate, and or is he seen as like this sort of evil king?
Not evil. Evil, I think, would be too much.
Right. You know,
but flawed, but human, and flawed in a way that interfered with his ability to be able to continue in that role, but definitely with many redeeming qualities, and many fine Jews today are named Shaul, good reason. It's got a lot to it, but it's complicated. So certainly it's not portrayed as evil, but complicated, and with some flaws that we have to figure out what exactly, or we see competing interpretations as to what exactly is the flaw that's focused on here, but it's clear that there's something. It's clear that there's an issue, not only in that the Gemara is highlighting, not only that there was something that he did wrong, but there was something in his reaction that continued to be wrong, that didn't allow him to continue as king. So it's also interesting, just to reflect for a second, especially because this week is also Parshas Vayikra, so we should talk about that as well. And this is a point that we mentioned last year when we were learning Sukkah and Mitzvah HaBavi Aveira, and it was also around Vayikra time. So it's particularly interesting. So the excuse that we were saving the animals to bring as a korban. So aside from the fact that that doesn't justify it, that that's not the Kedatsu Kedin, that that's not what they were told to do, so it's not a valid excuse, but it's not simply that it's not a good excuse. There's a much bigger flaw there also. And it's interesting to think about as we read Parshas Vayikra, because last year we spoke about, we were learning Sukkah, and we talked about Mitzvah HaBavi Aveira around this time of year. Parshas Vayikra also, we were holding in that sugi at the time, and we had some synergy to the Parsha, because when you learn the sugi of Mitzvah HaBavi Aveira, so you learn that Karbanos is one of the major sources for Mitzvah HaBavi Aveira, that the psul of Gozel, bringing a stolen mitzvah, is particularly relevant to Karbanos. And I mentioned then also that you learn Lulav HaGozel, so the parak that teaches us about the rules of Lulav and Esrog, the first halacha, in that parag, Lulav HaGazel, the first thing you learn is that it can't be stolen. All the complicated details of Lulav and Esrog, and there's so much to remember, and there's so much to figure out, but the first thing, the very first point, is it can't be stolen. So it's true also about Karbanos. So here we're starting Sefer Vayikra, and we have a lot of complicated details ahead of us about the Karbanos, and a lot to keep track of, and a lot of picture books, and a lot of charts and graphs to remember. But one of the drashos you find in Chazal, Kemat, the first din, the first thing you're told is that Karbanos can't be stolen. Because Chazal have a drasha on the opening lines of Sefer Vayikra, Adam ki akriv michem korban, that just like Adam Harishon, he didn't have anything to steal because everything was his. So too, Karbanos that are stolen are apostles. So following the path of the psukim based on the drashos, it means that the very first thing you find out at the very beginning of talking about Hilchos Karbanos is that it can't be stolen. And some point out, if I recall correctly, that when it comes to Karbanos, it's not only that it's mitzvah havavi avera. That's a problem in of itself. That the idea that you should do an avera for a mitzvah itself is problematic. But there is an internal stira that is much more significant when it comes to Karbanos. Because here we're saying that we're trying to do something that is l'ratzon, we're trying to appease God, we're trying to make Him happy. And the idea of making him happy through the Avera is particularly problematic, and some of the Rishonim understand, as we saw then, that mitzvah Babi Avera is specifically by mitzvos that have this theme of Ritzui, that are there to make God Kviyachal happy. But also, especially, what is the message? If you're going to steal a korban, if you're going to steal an animal and offer it as a korban, so that fundamentally skews and corrupts your understanding of what the korban is. Why do we bring korbanos? You bring korbanos because you think God needs the food? Is that the idea? So you're saying, okay, God, I know you need this korban, so I'm going to get it for you. Even if I have to steal it from someone else, I'll get it for you. It doesn't make any sense if that's what you're doing. So then it shows that it's not just that it's not justified, it shows that the whole theme of the korban is completely misunderstood. It means that you think that God needs this item, and therefore you have to get it from somewhere, even if you get it in illegitimate means. But clearly that's not what a korban is about. A korban is not providing God with some item that he needs you to obtain. The idea of the korban is what it reflects about coming from us. So if we stole it from someone else, it doesn't reflect that at all, and it reflects that we totally misunderstood what's going on here. So what would the chat be of sparing these animals so that you can bring them as a korban? It's basically saying, if you had a melech basar v'dam who needs something, and you say, okay, king, I know you told me to obliterate that nation, but they had some nice diamonds I think you'd appreciate, so I save them for you. Okay, so then maybe it makes sense with the melech basar v'dam. But how does that make sense at all in the realm of korbanos? That, oh, we saved these animals because, God, I know you'd really like these ones. So even though we were supposed to get rid of everything, I think you'll be happy that we held on to these to bring it as a korban. The very thought that that could make sense, it's not simply that it's not the din, it's that it makes the whole concept of korbanos into something completely turned on its head. It's like, oh, these are ones that God could use, these are ones he'll like, so I'll save them for him and it'll be appreciated in the end. So it's just striking that same issue where you find the mitzvah Babi Avera affecting on so many levels, and as we read that in Parshas Vayikra, so that's also a concept which seems to be contained here in the Haftarah as well, and making it perhaps a particularly appropriate fit for the Parsha that it connects with this year, on this leap year. The theme of Mechiyas HaMalek, of course, is one that we struggle with, and it's an area where we need the Gemara to tell us that we have to recognize that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's judgment is beyond what we are able to appreciate. Practically speaking, it's of course important to emphasize that we have no ability to carry this out b'zman hazeh. We assume that Sancheiriv came and shifted all the populations. It's true that there is a diuk in the Rambam that Chaim Brisker and others made about whether it's possible for the status of a Malik to be different than the other nations that were mixed up by by Sancheirev, and that it could be that there could be a identity of a Malik that could transcend that. But nonetheless, that's not relevant to us for practical halacha. You certainly have no right, chas v'shalom, to act violently against anybody on the basis of our interpretation of what this mitzvah asks us for. But the theme is certainly one that we have to reflect upon. And it seems that the theme is the abandonment of all decency and all ethics in war. That the Torah emphasizes that the Amalek attack happened on the weak and the stragglers, that it was essentially an act of terrorism. And that attitude, that there's nothing that holds us to any kind of standard, and that the world is hefkeris, and anything goes as far as practices of war, so the world essentially can't coexist with that. And the Kadosh Baruch Hu says you're not going to have a redeemed world as long as there is a ideology of a Malik. And it seems that a Malik is an ideology, especially according to those Rishonim who say that it's possible to convert out of a Malik. So it's not something that's genetic specifically, it's something that is tied to the nation, seems, on a cultural level. And at the same time, it's not midin onesh. It's midin that this is incompatible with a just world. And I think that's also what the Torah is getting at, and what's emphasized here is that it's not about punishment, and therefore even the children, they're not people who are subject to onshin at that age. So they're too young to be deserving of punishment, but they're not too young to pose a sakana to the world, that if they're being raised in that culture, so then that still creates an incompatible element for a peaceful world. Hi.
Under that, the fact that it's a state of mind, right? Is it also a nation? Like, because doesn't the Navi call the person who kills Shalom, mm-hmm. calls him half Amalek, right?
Yeah, it clearly starts from a familial identity. The question is, though, what is really driving that? Is it because that creates a cultural reality within that family, which extends even to the little children? And, you know, we've seen that the people, children of very young age, can be involved in acts of horrific violence and danger to the world. So it's not something that's inconceivable. We've seen that in our lifetime. It's theoretically possible. So is that the message? Very possibly. It's a machlokus about being mekabel gerim from a malik. Gemara does quote the idea that Bnei Banav Shel Haman Limdu Torah BeBnei Brak, which perhaps is also a part of the message. So there is a lot here that we have to try to understand and appreciate and know exactly what to do with. And that's essentially the mitzvah that we have the Shabbos, to remember the theme of Amalek. Just to say a few words about that practically, just so we have an idea of what we're doing. So you probably hear very often around this time of year announced that the Zechi of Minat Torah to go to Shul the Shabbos to hear the Kriya of Amalek, and that it's the only time, that the rest of the year Kriyas HaTorah is Drabanan, and this is the only time of the year that there's a Zechi of Minat Torah to hear the Leinen. So that might be, but every part of the sentence is a little bit questionable, just so you know in terms of background. First of all, the idea that it's the only time of the year, so that is some room to question also, because sounds like from some of the Rishonim it might be true about Parshas Para also. A number of Rishonim seem to say could be there are some other cases where the Kriya may at least have a claim towards being Daraisa. Could be Yontif, this is what to talk about. So it's not 100% clear that this is the only time that there is a Chi of Daraisa, but it's also not clear that this one is a Chi of Daraisa. It sounds like from the Rambam that all the Dalet Parshios are Midrabanan, that there's no special emphasis on Zachar more than others. And you have to figure out exactly how we get to this conclusion that there's a Chi of Daraisa for this Shabbos to hear Zachar. So there's a couple of elements. So yes, it's true that it is clear that the Torah says to remember a Malik. That's a clear mitzvah min HaTorah. So that we have Zachar al-Tishkach as Asher Asalacha Amalek, that we undoubtedly have. But how does that translate into an obligation to lane these psukim from a Sefer Torah with a minyan on the Shabbos before Purim? So that brings in a couple of other elements. So first of all, the Gemara does say one part of it. The Gemara says, Yachal b'peh. Yachal b'lev. Tam b'lomar al tishkach b'peh. So you could have thought that it's enough just to remember in your head. If you just remember a malik, that's enough. So the Torah says, no, al tishkach, that means it has to be done orally. So you have to at least say it out loud. So okay, so that much we have from the Gemara, but there's still a couple more steps to fill in. So how do you know the rest of it? So the idea that it has to be with a minyan and with a Sefer Torah, so that you find from some Rishonim, the idea that it's a Kriya, so Tostus in a few places seems to say that there is a Kriya Min HaTorah, and that's including a Malik. And the idea that it should be a Kriya from a Sefer Torah is an interesting question where you see that from. Some point to the Pasuk of Ksov Zos Zikaron B'Sefer. You should have the Zikaron in a Sefer, therefore it has to be from a Sefer Torah. Does it have to be a Kashra Sefer Torah, Pasha Pshat? Yes, but there was some discussion about that, whether it has the same requirements as normal laning. How do you know that it needs a minyan? So that's not so explicit in too many places either. Basically, it's from two statements of the Rishonim. One is there's a Rush, the Rush in the seventh parak of Brachos, where he said that Rabbi Elazar was Meshacher, his Eved, for a big mitzvah, and the mitzvah is Zachar Basar, that's what he seems to say. There is a lot of discussion whether that's the correct reading of the Rush, whether it's the correct words in the Rush. There's a lot of literature about that, but the Rush is one of the major sources to this effect. And there's a Truma Sadeshan also. The Truma Sadeshan has a tshuva where he was asked, or he discusses the question. It's always a history as to whether the Chuvas and the Trumas Hadeshin were actually responding to people asking questions. But the Trumas Hadeshin has a Chuva about somebody theoretically saying, I live in an area where we don't have a minyan. And I plan on going to an area where there is a minyan for Purim, so I can hear the Megillah. So once I'm doing that, should I also make sure to be there the Shabbos before, so I'll hear Zachar also? So the response is that not only should you do that, not only should you be there for Zachar, but that's a bigger chiyuv than Megillah, because Megillah doesn't really need a minyan, so you can read the Megillah by yourself. But Zachar you'll need a minyan for. So it sounds like, again, that you do need a minyan according to those Rishonim, you need a minyan and a kriya in order to have Parsha Zachar, and that's all a mitzvah min HaTorah. But again, others could disagree, but that's how the discussion has kind of unfolded out of Yom HaZeh. Maury?
I'm cheating a little bit because I have Rebbe's article on it.
Ah, that's true. Not allowed to do that.
He doesn't have a makor for that? Or he does source it into?
That's how he understands it. I think he does quote the Rush, actually. Should look at it again. Should have it in front of you. So, in any event, so this is somewhat of a machlokas, but that's the way it's properly understood. Then you still have the question, okay, so fine, so there's a mitzvah min HaTorah, let's say Neniach, a mitzvah min HaTorah to read Parsha Zachar from a Sefer Torah with a minyan. But who says you have to do it every year? Doesn't say how often to do it in the Torah. So how do you know that it's once a year? So that's a discussion. You know, there's some who suggest that you could have said maybe you should do it every day. Right? So in some of the Sidurim, they print the six Zechiros under the assumption that if you're supposed to remember these things, maybe we should recite them daily. Or you could say maybe it's once a lifetime. How do you know it's once a year? So there is a explanation. It's attributed to the Chasam Sofer. It's really brought from the Talmidim of the Chasam Sofer in his name, that if we're told not to forget, so he derives that there is a certain period of time after which people start to forget things, a shir shikha. And if we're told not to forget, so we have to make sure not to let that period of time go by when you could end up forgetting. So how long is the Shir Shekha? So it derives that it's 12 months. How do you know that it's 12 months? From two Gemaras. One is the Gemara in Brachos. It says that Ein HaMeis Mishtakech Menalev El Achayir Beis Chodesh, that a person starts to forget about a relative who's passed away after 12 months. And the Gemara in Bava Metzia, that Stam Yeish is 12 months, that after somebody hasn't found their property in 12 months, so we assume they're Miayish. So if that's the case, so then we want to stop 12 months from passing, and we have Parsha Zachar to remind us every 12 months. So maybe that got us in trouble this year then. So there are some who discuss, so wait a second, but it was a leap year. So it means it's 13 months between the two Purims. So isn't that a problem? So that's a discussion whether that's a problem or not. Some have the Eitzah that in a year such as this past year, so we should have had, this is too late to tell you this now, but that when we read Parshas Kisetze over the summer, this past summer, so you should have Kavanah then to be Yotze Parshas Zachar. And there's a whole interesting discussion. Should Rishi Pesach Frank has a tshuva? Does the Bal Koreh have to know to be Motzi people? Is it that kind of a thing? So there's a lot written about that. You could argue that it's not necessarily a problem. Rabbi Willig, I remember, gave a shiur about this when I was in college, my first year, so we used to have a more organized Junesman structure. Maybe someday we will again. But there was the whole yeshiva learned a parak together, and they had shiur klalis in the base medrash every day from the different Rashi yeshiva. So that year we were learning Bava Metzia, and so in June I learned Eilu Metzias, learned the second parak, and Rabbi Willig was that year in Avelis for finishing Avelis for his mother. So he talked about this concept of the Shir Shikha, the 12 months, and he explained that he doesn't think it means literally 12 months, that if you have a year that's 13 months long, then you have exceeded it. But rather, what it means is that when the cycle of a year goes, so then your brain kind of resets and you don't remember things from before that. So something happened on Hanukkah, then by the time you hit the next Hanukkah, so you start to forget what happened last Hanukkah. But if it's a 13-year cycle, if it's a 13-month cycle, so it's a 13-month cycle. It doesn't have to be literally 12 months. He wasn't so worried about that. There are others who dispute the whole idea of the Shir Shekha, the Sab Merav HaZetshuva, where he explains, thinks both of these proofs are not really relevant. And the idea of Hameis Mishtakech Menalev, that means that when a person is trying to get over a loss and he's actively trying to get past it, so after 12 months it starts to work. It doesn't mean that all of a sudden if you have a mitzvah to remember something, it's going to evaporate after 12 months. And the idea of Stam Yeish, so Yeish is not about forgetting, Yeish is about giving up hope. So okay, so after 12 months you don't think you're going to find it again. It doesn't mean that you forgot about it. So he disputes the idea of a Shir Shekha, and he understood that the idea of every 12 months is because Chazal wanted to connect it to Purim. So because of its thematic relevance to Purim, we have the Kriya then. But it's not that that's inherent in the Mitzvah Daraisa, and presumably you could do it a different time, like over the summer, or possibly on Purim itself. It's also a machlokas whether the Kriya that we read on Purim of Vayavu Amalek, the psukim from Parshas Bishalach, maybe that could be a fulfillment of Zechiras Amalek. It's a question, what exactly is the nature of the mitzvah? Is the mitzvah to remember the tzivoy that we have in Kiseitze? Is the mitzvah to remember the Parsha of the war? So that's somewhat of a machlokas, and that impacts on that discussion. There were those who felt a different Ravid thought that the fulfillment of Zechiras Amalek in learning Maseches Megillah, learning the halachas that come out of Purim and that are all connected back to Amalek, but that's a key, which is a very interesting suggestion, has some other ramifications. So there is much to discuss about this. It's also interesting and very Nogei L'maisa, extremely Nogei L'maisa. So part of the announcement we say is that this is the one time of the year when there's a chiyuv daraisa to come to shul, and everybody has to come, men and the women also. So as we've seen, there's some room for machlokas on every word of this announcement. So what about the men and the women? So that's a big machlokas also. So Sefer Achinuch writes that women are pater from this mitzvah. It's not clear why that should be, especially because we've just established that it's not a mitzvah saseh shazman grama, because the Torah does not define it at any particular moment. Even if our convention has been to do it at this time, it's not inherently restricted to that time. So why should it be something that women are pater from? So some explain, the Ma'acheshes and others, that because it's connected to the Melchemes HaMalek, and Melchemes HaMalek women aren't involved in. But that itself is a little challenging, because the Mishnah says in Sota that a Melchemes Mitzvah women are involved in. So it's a discussion, why should women be pater? And indeed, many thought they weren't pater. So that's an issue that's a continuing machlokas. You'll find Bisman Azeh, different views on this question, whether women are indeed chayavos in Amalek, and the whole institution of having additional readings in order to make it possible for parents to come to shul at different times. Is that necessary? Is that justified? So there's a lot of literature about that. That's an ongoing machlokas, the question of the chiyuv nashim in Mechiyas HaMalek. So all the details of the announcement are a little bit subject to debate, but nonetheless, that's the position that seems to have won, that there is a unique mitzvah min HaTorah, unique as far as the course of the year, unique mitzvah min HaTorah to come to shul the Shabbos that applies to all the men and the women. So just to say 1 minute of Al Pi Derech HaDrush, perhaps, to understand it. So if we want to say that maybe the tam of the mitzvah is the fight against evil in this world, and we have to be able to recognize it and understand it, and to appreciate that it's not that we live in a morally relativistic framework where things are just good and good in different ways and everything can be justified and rationalized, but there are some forces that are objectively bad and nothing is going to paper over that. So even if you say that we're Makabel Geirim from Amalek, we're not talking about people necessarily, but we're talking perhaps about ideologies or actions. So even if you say you can accept Geirim from Amalek, it means, yes, a person can leave the status of Amalekus, but Amalekus is never anything other than Amalekus. Amalekus is bad and is irredeemable, even if the human beings involved might be redeemable. And that has to be understood, and perhaps, maybe you could suggest that that's why we have this idea of doing it B'tzibur and the Sefer Torah, that two of the components, which are sometimes able to take over and to offset flaws, are the Torah and the Tzibur. We say that we try to strive for Tefillah B'Tzibur, because even if we are flawed as individuals, but the Tefillah B'Tzibur is accepted. So there is an inyan that the Tzibur is able to make up for our deficiencies, and the Torah is able to lift us up. So perhaps we want to make the announcement that when it comes to Amalek, that nothing is going to change it. Amalek is still Amalek, even when we're reading from a Sefer Torah, even when we're doing so B'Tzibur, it's still Amalek, and that's something that we have to be able to recognize and appreciate. But we also can't let an attitude of violence or vengeance come to affect our personality, and we can't come to think that that itself is good. And that's again a theme that we spoke about recently, and that's how we assume that we don't make a bracha on this mitzvah. And we don't make a bracha on this mitzvah, so many explain that it's based on the concept that since it involves people dying, even if these people are evil, that's not something that we celebrate, that's not something that we're happy about. Whether or not it's comparable is a machlokas, is a discussion of just how fitting a comparison this is, but it's compared to the idea that Chazal tell us that we only say half hallel on the last days of Pesach, because the loss of the mitzrim is something that we acknowledge with some degree of at least compromised celebration. So too, this isn't something that we delight in, this isn't something that gets its own bracha, but it's nonetheless a mitzvah that has its themes and messages that we have to be able to fully appreciate for what they are, and be ready as Shaul was apparently not fully ready to appreciate the infinite wisdom of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in all of his directives. Okay, so we will stop here. Wish everyone a peaceful Shabbos Acher, and stay in touch. I assume it will be about 9:30 Sunday morning. We'll try to use that time on Sunday morning.